Welcome to Discussion at Brookings Cafe, a discussion about virtually anything, an opportunity for you to express your opinion on virtually any topic. While the cafe is fictitious, the table is quite real, and the people who come here talk about topics we hope you will find interesting and important to our community. More importantly, we hope you will come visit the table and become a part of the dialogue. Let's see who's at the table today.
Welcome to another edition of Discussions at Brookings Cafe. I'm Ray Gary, and I'm going to be your host today, and we have a wonderful guest who's going to talk about how to take care of your landscape. And we also have a guest host. So maybe we should go around. We'll start out by just going around the table and have everybody introduce themselves and who they are and tell us a little bit about why you're here. Do you want to start out, Scott?
My shoulder's being tapped. I guess that's me.
Yeah.
My name's Scott Thiemann, and I'm with OSU Extension, our Curry County branch, and I coordinate the Master Gardener Program for Curry County, which has a lot to do with coordinating various educational events and activities with all our volunteers.
Okay. Janice?
And I am Janice, and I moved to Brookings a year ago, and I moved from Redding, California, and I am having such a good time gardening here in Brookings. Everything just seems to work most of the time, and I don't want to do much else during my day except to be outside in that yard.
I, too, am impressed at how well everything moves. I used to have a winter house in Tucson, and I probably had maybe a 40-50% success rate when I planted things. And here it's like 110%. They not only grow, they grow way over the other side of the yard, too, because somehow or other they've spread. So, Scott, do you want to tell us about the Master Gardener Program?
I do, yeah. We begin our 2020 Master Gardener training in a couple months. It's the first day is actually January 10th. It ends March 13th. So it's a 10-week course, and it's for people who are willing to take what they learn and to volunteer and help educate others and support others in their landscape and gardening pursuits here in Curry County. So we're going to be starting that fairly soon. It's the registration cutoff is 1 month from yesterday, so on November 15th. Asking everybody to have their registrations in. We have room for 18 in the class, and right now we have 5. So there's still plenty of room, but those spots will probably fill up quickly, especially as we get closer to the deadline. To register, you just go to our Curry County Master Gardener webpage, and there's several ways to get to the actual location to register it by going to the events label, or there's an announcement you can also just click on. So there's numerous ways that it should get you there. And then you sign up online, just some basic information about who you are, as well as giving us some background about your garden pursuits and history and the reasons you'd like to become a master gardener in Curry County. The cost for the course is $175. And we even rebate, I guess is the right word to use, $60 of that at the end of the course, at the end of the time that you help support with your volunteer hours. We actually do it all at one time, and the volunteer hours go from the beginning of the year basically till October 31st. So we're getting really close to the end of our reporting year, and then, you know, if you have your hours in, which most people do, you get $60 back, as well as your Master Gardener badge.
So if I am in need of one of these volunteer Master Gardeners, how do I find them? I knew there were Master Gardeners, but I didn't realize that their purpose in life was to help other people. I know some people that are, but none of them ever said, oh yeah, Ray, I'll come up and help you out. But
well, we
and
don't.
Are they obligated to do that?
No,
I call them up and say,
no, actually,
Scott told me you have to come and do this.
If you have a neighbor that's a master gardener, I'm sure they would be able to help you at your place. We don't do residential visits generally. Occasionally, we do. Occasionally, I will. But we'll answer questions. You can take pictures and send them to us, either to me directly at my email address, which I'll give you, is scott.thiemann, and then my last name is spelled T-H-I-E-M-A-N-N, at oregonstate.edu, and I'll do my best to help you out. Usually it's sufficient to be able to do that, but if there's a lot of questions regarding potential plant diseases or problems, we might be able to make a site visit.
Speaking of pictures, I took a bunch of pictures this morning, and then when Janice came in, she reminded me that this is a radio show and we won't be able to use the pictures, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, we're there to help people. We just finished a library speaker series. Our last topic was on urban permaculture, which was very interesting. We had one of our master gardeners put that together, as well as plant-based whole food or plant-based diet, previous presentation there. And we have numerous topics that people speak on, and that's part of our mission, is to educate and get information to the general public.
I have somebody staying at my house right now temporarily who, I don't know if she took your permaculture course or somebody else's, but she's kind of obsessed with it. And she, every time I say, well, what should I plant there? She's got fruit trees. You got to have fruit trees. And then if I plant a tree, then I have to have something else close to it, or this has to shade that. And then she gets angry when she comes back and I haven't done it.
I heard a show on permaculture on this radio station. I think it was on Reality Check. And there was a couple from Port Orford who were talking about practicing it in their space up there. And it sounded really fascinating and very, very intricate and a lot of work. But I'd like to know more about it. Can you just give us a little layman definition?
Permaculture comes from permanent agriculture. It's the idea that you use what is on site to accomplish your goals and not have a lot of additional materials and treatments, whatever it is to bring in, to do your landscaping and especially your gardening. Because for the most part, when people are thinking permaculture, they're thinking agriculture, they're thinking gardening. And so, as an example, you would be growing trees for the purpose, perhaps, of either firewood or shredding up into mulch or, something along that line. You'd grow your vegetables, your herbs, your plants in zones, and the ones that would require the most care would be grown closest to the house, or the ones you would use the most, like herbs, would be closest to the house, and then maybe your vegetable garden would be the next furthest thing away, and then like fruit trees would be even further. And probably part of the idea, I would think, would also be that the smaller plants that would need more sun would have more room and, maybe be closer to the house. But you take everything into consideration. You take your water sources, you take your sun exposure, which you do anyhow, really, in landscaping. It's not that much different. It's just that you're really conscientious about treating your area as like one ecological system, mm-hmm. rather than individual plots just for decorative purposes, maybe, or separating everything out. Often in permaculture too, and I don't know, this is where I think about practicality, because I've not seen much grown successfully here in the Northwest, as far as there's also levels that you will plant at, and that's probably what your friend is concerned about, with the idea of fruit trees and then other plants underneath. But some of the issues, it's the obvious one right there, is the sun and also water that's going to be taken by other plants. So it's a real trick, I think, to get it right, and you have to experiment a lot of gardening, about gardening is experimentation.
Do they use companion planting with the vegetable gardening?
Yeah, that would be all of those kinds of things. They would try to use what would be considered probably a more natural or organic approach in their gardening to accomplish their end goals. The class that we just had with Ken was interesting because we were talking about urban permaculture. It was a little bit different approach. And I'd say a lot of that has to do with thinking about what your neighbors are growing and seeing where their how their plantings are, and that's going to affect what you plant and how you plant. And maybe if you're doing this as a neighborhood, I mean, idealistically, I suppose, or ideally, would be to have different people growing different things, you know, so that you could share your harvest. And that way you know, people don't think about often when they're growing an apple tree, just how many apples they're going to get and how many trees do you really need, you know. And that's part of the trick, I think, of being effective at, as a gardener, is not overdoing it in the sense of having so many different varieties. I mean, you know, some people like them for eating and some for juicing and that kind of thing. But, you know, keeping that in mind when you're putting your garden together. And you might even look at your neighbors as an example for pollinators, cross-pollination of, say, apples or pears, that kind of thing. So that would be, those are kinds of things you might look at in town, whereas if you're trying to do something, you know, on a larger acreage, then you'll have a different approach.
You mentioned using natural things, and I assume that would certainly include compost, right, as opposed to...
Yeah.
So I have these compost bins, and they're like barrels, like 40-gallon barrels on things that rotate. And I just completely filled one up just the other day with when I cut the hydrangeas and other things and weeds. And so how long will that take to cook now and be something worth using?
You're going into winter, so it's going to take many, many months. You know, you just don't have the heat. And you need a lot of nitrogen-based kinds of things, like just grass, you know, that really will compost quickly if you're going to be successful. One of the things you may be concerned about or may really want to think about when you put your composting together is, are you putting in plants, weeds particularly, in their seeds? Because if you don't reach a certain temperature, you're not going to kill those seeds. So you're going to be taking out your compost, recombining it, putting it where you want.
Good point.
And then you're going to end up with, you know, all those weeds coming back because you didn't kill the seeds. And seeds have a long lifetime often. You know, people don't think about that. I mean, when part of the issue when we dig a garden and we bring up some of that soil to the surface, there's a lot of seeds still there that will end up re-germinating. So weeding can be a lot of work, and there's ways of trying to do things that will keep that labor down. And I'm big. One of my biggest encouragements to people is maintenance-free and maintenance, low maintenance.
I shared with you that weed that I have in my yard that's rampant, and we thought it was a type of sorrel. Mm-hmm. So how do you recommend eradicating that?
Well, I know people aren't going to like this answer, but when you have weeds that have the kinds of roots that sorrel does, where you break it off and you get new weeds, if you don't end up killing the top vegetation, you're just going to have new weeds coming up. If you want to keep digging it, you can get rid of it. You just have to keep after it. But then again, if you do that, then you won't be able to plant other things there. Glyphosate and the common brand, you know, people are familiar with Roundup, is often something that folks will use. But I mean, it's trying not to use, most people don't want to use sprays. They don't want to use weed killers and things like that. So one of the things to consider is really being on top when you do your weeding, and also you're going to have to be persistent. You could put cardboard on top, that might help. That's a really nice, I guess you'd say, kind of natural approach. Cardboard will break down and should be fine in the soil. It will also cover and gradually probably kill most of the plant, which will hopefully do the roots in as well. If they have nowhere to grow to, that will be one way to probably eliminate the plants. Another thing you can do is you can compost or mulch on top of an area or on top of some weeds, and that might help. But something like sorrel is going to probably just grow right up back through.
Oh, it's the worst thing I've ever had to deal with.
Yeah, so
I have about 400 square feet on my property now that I've covered with 6 mil plastic, and I plan on leaving that there until, I don't know, June or something, and would that help Genesee's situation? Although,
yeah,
she might be concerned about the aesthetics of black plastic there all the time, but I'm not where I put it.
Yeah, people actually, that's considered a quote unquote mulch in a way too, as you could cover an area with plastic.
I've got it within my planting beds as well.
Yeah,
where it's impossible to cover it. And I do weed it periodically, more than I like to have to. But if I really get that root that goes, it ends up going under all other plants. And, you know, I'm just uprooting a lot of the area.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes, there's a lot of work in gardening and in landscaping. I'd say the most important thing you can do is to try to get it right from the beginning. And that may be why you would want to spray something initially to really knock it down. It doesn't mean that there won't be other seeds that you won't have to deal with, but if you get an initial start and then from then on, especially if it's not going to be used for food, because people have, you know, various ideas about that, and to get really accurate research and information is a challenge in that area. People react emotionally to sprays, and you know, it's, again, I personally would rather not spray something, but if it's going to take me hours and hours to do something that I could do in 5 minutes, I'm going to think twice about it. And everybody has to make those decisions. And the idea is to not overuse and to use wisely. And if you're spraying, you know, don't just take the wand and cast it all over everything. Just spot spray the areas that you really intend or need to deal with.
I've tried Preen, which is supposedly safe. It's not. It's not a problem.
Pre-emergent.
For your health. Pre-emergence.
Yeah, that's one. That is a pre-emergence you can use. I know there's another one I'm trying to remember that I just hate the smell of. Just because of the smell, it just puts me off. Castoron, I think it is. But, you know, those are both pre-emergence. Those are ways to keep your weeding down to a minimum.
Would that take care of Genesis' problem, you think?
No. I don't, when you have established roots, that's a good question. I would think it would have some effect, but I'm not sure, you know, if it's coming directly from seed, probably would be the same. I'm not sure.
Really. I have a lot of it, like I said, in my planting beds where I wouldn't want to use Preen because I'm always casting seeds.
Yeah.
And keep seeds from sprouting, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're gathering a lot of volunteers then?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, yes.
What, can you define what partial sun is?
Okay, here's what I call partial sun. I mean, partial sun can be a lot. And on the coast, probably the less partial, the better. If partial sun to me is where you have openings throughout the day and sun coming through at different angles, kind of hitting the same spot. If you plant something under a dense tree, I would not call that partial sun. If you have angles of sun, say half a day, that would be partial sun. If you have maybe morning sun, that would be partial sun. But when it comes to vegetables and gardening, you really want as much sun as you can get. One of the reasons, one of the things you'd really want to consider is get planting on the south side of your house, or say a south-facing slope, and be sure that there aren't neighbors' trees that are blocking your sun at that, in those spots. So if you're going to plant out a vegetable garden, do it in the sunniest spot in your yard, if you can.
Okay.
I mean, you know, or if you choose to. I mean, some people don't want it in their front yards. But I mean, if that's the sunniest part, or if that's south facing, that's probably where you would do the best.
A lot of times if I go to a nursery and I buy a plant that has a little tag on there and it talks about drought resistant and all that, and it will say good in partial sun. So that'd be someplace that gets sun a few hours a day as opposed to all day. Or?
Yeah, and one thing you might want to consider, especially when you guys get the Chetko effect here, is if you have a west-facing spot in mind, you may want to think twice with the sun beating down on those plants. Because even if it's a half day when it gets extremely hot, you know, rhody leaves will burn and, I mean, all sorts of different plants, but they come to mind. That's where I see the most damage usually when it comes to sun effect on you know.
So when plants. You say burn, I have some, I actually brought some pictures, but I guess it wouldn't be fair to the audience. I have these little brown spots on some of my rhodies, and maybe the leaves curl a little. And I've tried fertilizing them with an acid fertilizer, and then I water about every 3 days for a half hour with a sprinkler, so I think they're getting plenty of water. So that might be the effects of too much sun?
No, sun usually shows up more truly as it looks burned. I mean, it has a brown area that's just, it's not...
Parched.
It's, yeah, it just has a different look than, say, a fungus would or something if you have... Or even little brown spots, which could be all sorts of things.
Maybe too much water.
I don't know.
I made the
mistake of putting azaleas and rhododendrons in a planter, and I'm sure that's going to restrict their growth somewhat. They're going to.
Yeah.
I need to move them.
It will. Yeah. If you put plants in containers, the containers really act as a bonsai for that plant.
Really? This, when I say planter, the planter is about 20 feet long and 3 feet deep and about 2.5 feet wide.
They should do pretty well in there. They may not, you know, they'll reach probably a certain size or grow more slowly still, but they should do pretty well in that much soil. Let me give you an example of something I did. Someone gave me some hop starts, and I just kind of like them as vines, and I thought I'd grow them, you know, and I had two in pots, just gallon pots, and they were little plants, and they looked the same for almost 2 years, and kind of yellowing leaves, they just weren't happy. But when I put one in the ground, it took a little while, but once it takes, I mean, that you'll see when plants are getting established, they grow quite quickly and differently. And so I had this one I pulled out, and it had much bigger leaves, and they were much greener, and it was just in our regular soil. We don't really need to fertilize much here when it comes to most of our decorative ornamental plants. Not saying it won't benefit them, but usually plants, unless people are really looking to put on a lot of growth or put it on faster for something, for some reason, generally plants, like you were saying earlier, right, you know, that they come up on the other side of your yard. I mean, you know, it's the soil here does plants do fairly well. And even given that a lot of it can be very, very acidic, unless you're really clay-y kind of soil type.
My house was built on a hillside, so they notched the hillside to build the house. And so I don't have topsoil there. I have whatever was 2 or 3 feet down, and so whenever I plant something, I augment the dirt with a good 50% of compost or some type of planting soil, and they seem to do fine.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, but I'm glad you don't just plop or create a space that's soil where the soil is totally different. You want to incorporate the native soil in along with, you know, the like you used a word, I can't remember what you just said, but
augment.
Yes. Yeah, augmented. Yeah, so I mean that's a good plan generally.
Okay, so that I want. So I dig a hole if I'm planting a bush about twice the size of the pot it came in and about twice as deep, and then I fill it. No.
Not twice as deep. That's the old rule.
Well, I fill it back in. No.
Generally not. Maybe just a little bit underneath, but you're really the general rule of thumb now is just twice as wide, maybe a little wider, and just you don't have to dig it deeper than pretty much the size of the pot it came in. That's been recommended for a long, long time. What you said. Previous to, I'd say the last maybe 10, 20 years, the ideas about that has really changed.
So I've got this little area now that's twice as big as what the plant was growing in with augmented soil, and it's all nice and happy and everything. And then these roots are spreading, and they eventually get to the edge of this augmented soil, and now they've got to get into all this
and hopefully
junk. Are they adapting as they go? Or
Yeah, hopefully. By doing that, that will allow for them to do fine, to take off. But if you just put, especially if your soil's really compacted, putting them in really nice soil with that and with like not augmented, not mixing the native soil, they will often reach the edge of that hole and they won't go any further. So that's. At least that's my understanding. That's what I've been told or, read for quite some time. And there's another trick, and this is just, I'd say, much more recent than this, and this is about planting your potted plants in pots. People often put gravel or whatever in the bottom, quote unquote, for drainage. Well, if you have no drainage, that may not be a good idea to have that plant.
There's
in the
nothing
pot.
To drain too.
Right. But what happens is it reaches the end of the of that area, and it doesn't help the plant whatsoever. It has to do with the way water moves through the soil. So it really, you'd think that you want to get the water away, but it really isn't an advantage to do that. You want a pot that has holes or breathes. And so, that will take care of that issue. You don't need to put anything like gravel or broken up pots. People have been doing that forever in the, clay pots in the bottom of a planter.
I've heard it's a good idea to put a piece of coffee filter over the hole so the dirt won't escape.
Yeah, that might be fine. Just so the water can still drain out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, sometimes some of those pots have pretty big holes at the bottom. And I don't think there'd be anything wrong with like kind of semi-plugging them up with rocks either, but water would still get through it. But then, like you're saying, if a lot of soil's coming through, And I'd say that's probably more aesthetic or for reasons of just depending where you have the pot. You don't want soil coming out all over your kitchen counter or wherever, especially if it's a house plant or indoors.
Can we talk about deer for a minute?
You can talk about deer. A lot of people do.
I have very undiscriminatory deer in my yard. They eat salvias. They eat milkweed.
Wow.
They have bitten the top off of and yanked out of the ground two euphorbias.
Wow. I'm saying, because I have deer coming through my yard and they eat none of these. Now, I don't have milkweed, but I've had very few issues at my place except for hydrangea. And they like my grape hyacinth. Let's see, what else do they chew on? These are things that were put in there before I moved in. And
I don't want to have to end up caging my whole front yard. I have a back area that is deer-proof.
Okay, that's good, but especially if it's your food garden.
I have some neighbors that openly feed deer. I was walking down to the mailbox the other day, and a gentleman was feeding a deer, and I said, "Bill, you're feeding the deer." And he said, oh, no, no, I'm just giving him a cookie. And I said, Bill, you're feeding the deer. And he's going to continue to feed the deer, as are these neighbors on that block and these on that block. And they love doing it, and they love telling you they do, and they're not going to not do it. You know, would it behoove me to campaign about this? Do you think that their feeding them is enticing them more to our area?
It's definitely not discouraging them. Bill, if you're listening.
Janice, if you start feeding me, I'll come around all the time.
Yeah, there you go.
But they have...
And I won't eat your garden, though. I'll just...
They have enough in my yard to eat, or that they enjoy eating. There's empty grasslands there that they eat. Mm-hmm. They can eat the weeds. You always see them munching.
Yeah. Yeah, they munch around my place. I kind of talk loud at them when I see them, and just kind of keep moving on.
Oh, they don't move at my house. They just stare at me.
Yeah, well, they're used to people, and they definitely do stare. I've seen that a lot, too. You know, all I can do is we could make recommendations, and there'd be lists of plants that might do better than others. I can tell you, though, that sometimes their interests change. I know that we had artichokes planted outside of our fence because I'd come to the understanding that generally deer don't bother them. Well, the first year they were fine, and then second year they weren't. They all of a sudden developed a taste, and they were into the artichokes, so I moved them into our garden area, and I moved rhubarb. I moved rhubarb plants out from where I had them. So, and they didn't seem to bother those, at least, you know, now. And so I don't know what their tolerance.
Maybe they will tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't know what their tolerance is. You know, different things poison different mammals, so it's hard to know, you know, how they'll react to anything, and if it.
I can't
tasty or whatever.
I can't think of the what are those yellow yellow plants?
Candy?
The yellow things that are invasive. Is it Scotch something?
Oh, Scotch broom.
Scotch broom. Yeah, I saw. Supposedly nothing eats those, and last year I saw a deer nibbling on those. So
hopefully they eat all the flowers, because at least they'll stop it from going to seed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've pretty much eradicated it in my yard, but But I have to cut it down every year. I didn't eradicate it, but I don't let it go to seed and don't let it spread.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I have one thing I hate to say now. If you've just joined us, I really wish you wouldn't do that. I wish you would try to get here on time. You know, everybody is here and seated, and everybody's listening. And you know, you're just coming in late like this. You're disrupting the whole thing. We have guests that have come. Anyway, if you have just joined us, you probably don't know that this is KCIW Radio in Brookings, Oregon. And you're listening to Brookings Cafe.
Scott, I'd like to ask you about growing greens here.
Right.
I've had very good luck with arugula.
Okay.
And are we able to grow that all year long? I was also wondering about kale and chard and spinach.
Once you have those plants established, you probably can harvest them throughout the winter. Right now, unless you put in starts, and even if you put in starts, it's getting pretty late. I mean, planting things seed by seed now just really aren't going to do you much good. If you have starts in a greenhouse or something, you might try planting them out with some luck. Those would be hardier, and they definitely grow through the winter. So once they get established, they should do well. And that's nice to have fresh greens in the winter.
It does get too hot, though, in the summer for them?
No, not necessarily. What you'll see often, though, is certain plants, just depending when they're planted and maybe the different varieties and stuff, will go to seed, especially when they get a warm, you know. And if they aren't watered properly, I mean, there's a lot of things I think that could set that off. But they're you're pretty successful with most of the brassicas around here. You know, your definite challenge might be something like slugs, but you know, they seem to. We haven't yet got a couple of the diseases that are prevalent in the valley. I'm trying to think of the one. Brown leg or something like that. That's become quite common in the valley on broccoli. It could be a real, you know, real difficult one to control. One thing to do too with gardens, if you can, and this is where it's always a challenge with space, is to rotate, you know, different families of plants. Mm-hmm. So that's something else you could try. We can give you more information on that at Extension, which I should give the number out for, right?
Might as well.
If you have plant questions, you can call me, Scott, at OSU Extension, and our number's 541-247-6672. And would be happy to answer. Just email me at scott.thieman@oregonstate.edu.
Now, how about tomatoes? I have two neighbors that grow tomatoes. They have terrific success with cherry tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really good. One of them has learned through the years to not even try a larger tomato. The other one keeps on trying, and she shares them with me. And to tell you the truth, I can hardly eat them.
Wow.
They don't have any taste. They're mealy, mushy.
Okay. And they're fresh garden tomatoes, huh?
Yes.
Wow. Well, you know, it depends on the variety that you grow, and there's certain ones that do better here. Oregon State does a lot of experimenting with varieties, and we can give you those again by calling me, and we can tell you what you might want to consider as being the most successful. Cherry tomatoes do much better in general. They, for whatever reason, maybe the size, I don't know what it is, but they just are easier to grow here. You can often grow those maybe even in town. But when it comes to the other ones, where are you located?
Very close to the ocean off of Tanbark.
Okay, well, it's encouraging to hear that they're able to grow larger tomatoes, a greenhouse situation, or?
No.
No. Okay, well, that's good. I mean,
but they're not, I mean, she grows them, yes, and they turn a beautiful red, but.
Yeah, we hear lots of stories of people growing tomatoes that are still green. And that's because of the heat units and needed for to be successful with things like them, and especially melons or peppers, especially eggplant. We just don't have the heat unless maybe you live up the river valleys, and even then you might want a hot spot. So one thing people could try is growing, if you're trying something like tomatoes too, is maybe grow them next to the house on a south-facing wall. That would reflect some heat, give them a little bit more possibility of reaching maturity.
Mm-hmm.
When I used to live on Long Island in New York, that's evidently the absolute perfect place to grow tomatoes. The soil is just has enough drainage. It has a little bit of sand mixed in it, and the temperatures are just right. And I don't know, around the middle of summer, getting rid of tomatoes was like trying to get rid of kittens. Everybody came to work with a bag of tomatoes. You want some? No, I've got some. You want some? And it was just an incredible place to grow tomatoes.
Yeah.
I used to grind it up and make tomato sauce and things like that with it, so I kind of had it through the winter.
One of the reasons probably more successful too, especially back east, is you have warmer evenings.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for one of the issues that people don't consider when it comes to gardening often is the soil temperatures. And the soil temperatures until late spring really don't get very warm here. So things will just, you've probably done this where you've been out in your, you know, planted something out in your garden, especially if it's something like a tomato, and you just stare and stare and stare at it, and it just seems to never put on another leaf. It's just sitting there. And it's just so cool that, you know, things until they actually get the temps they need, will they will just vegetate. That does not mean put on vegetation. And it's interesting. What was his name? Steve or Rick Solomon, last name Solomon, who started Territorial Seeds. He had charts of how different things will grow and how quickly they'll grow once they're planted later and later into the spring. Unfortunately, we don't have even that, let's say opportunity, but conditions quite right in the sense that the soil temperature is so cool here that we don't want to wait too long. You know, most of the time when you get your veggies in by mid-May, you'll be okay, but it depends on what you're planting again. And then you can plant a lot of things. We've already talked about it, like kale and lettuces, carrots, radishes, all those kind of things when the temps are cooler and earlier in the spring. Some you just want to plant directly out.
So if I'm starting a vegetable raised bed, and I put soil that I have in there and different things I've collected and compost. And should I be doing tests on that soil to check chemical levels or whatever it would be?
Yeah, you can. You'll want to probably take from several different locations in the bed. We have the information as master gardeners how to do a pH test, and we can do those for you. I think it's only $5.
Uh-huh.
And I can send you out the forms, and then we can collect the soil. The fellow's right here in Brookings, in fact, who does that. So we could do that for pH, but that's all we test. If you really want an extensive reading of, you know, all the elements in your soil and what levels they're at in nutrients, then you'd have to send it off to a lab. And we have lists of those too that you can send them off to. But, you know, it's generally what you're doing is you're planting in a lower pH, so you may want to augment your soil with some lime or something to raise the pH. And people on their lawns, especially down here, often need to apply lime if they're going to have a, you know, the greener lawn and have a better better growing conditions for the grass.
Yeah, with the trees I have around my house, I'm sure my soil that must be very high acid, the native soil anyway that I haven't brought anything into.
Yeah, most likely, not always, but often find it to be fairly acidic.
Yeah.
The berries, that's part of the reason you see blackberries just coming up everywhere.
Everywhere.
They really like that, yeah.
Yeah, and they have no respect at all. They just come back and come back.
And you were talking about your sorrel earlier on. Though that's another example of something where you'd really want to try to get to it early. And one thing you can do, there's things you can do, and they wouldn't be where you end up not having to, except sorrel's not one of them, but that where you don't end up maybe having to spray at least at the extent that you might otherwise, if that's the only route you're going to take, is you could mow. Once you knock down the berries, you could just keep mowing them and trying to basically to the point where you wear them out, and, you know, or at least they're easy to mow, and then you don't have to dig them all out. But
you're talking about blackberries.
Blackberries, yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about pruning shrubs a little bit. I remember hearing when I was a kid about you prune the shrub depending on when the bloom season was. So if it bloomed in the spring and stopped, you pruned it one time versus if the plant bloomed all summer and fall. Is that?
Yeah, sometimes you have to be careful with certain bushes and all. Forsythia is one where you don't want to prune it until it stops flowering, or until it's gone through its flowering, because you'll prune off, you know, all of the year flowers to come. So you have to look at what it is and know which season to prune it in, and certain things you prune differently, you know, especially if you're going to do something like hedge them, you know, compared to not. A lot of people they'll like flowers, say like on a Escalonia, and those little pink flowers, but they never see them because they're always having to hedge it before they get them. I mean, you know, and so you have to take certain things into consideration before you make the choices of what you put in your yard.
When would you prune an Escalonia?
Oh, Escalonia I would do all the time too.
Whenever.
It's just one of those that because of how quickly it grows, unless you're going to let it just become this big moundy plant, you're not going to see the flowers, or very few.
What about Mexican sage?
As far as flowers, I don't know. I would have to look that up as far as when to prune a lot of things, actually. And that one, you can prune a lot of shrubs any time, but when it comes down to the flower season, that's where you're going to have to really, you know, go back. I've been away from doing, I used to do landscape work a lot and maintenance, and had a much better idea of a lot of plants then. And since then, I've gotten away from that. And so you really want to look, and you'll check it out before.
Maybe early in the spring before new growth.
Yeah, I think spring's a good time to do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But you look it up or call us, and then we'll look it up and see which season would be best if you're trying to maintain the flowers.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to say, kind of reaching the end of the time we have here, is we've had a couple different landscaping classes offered, and had one recently in Gold Beach that I led. We kind of did a basic landscaping basics talk, and then we went out and looked at various landscapes. And it's amazing what you can still do, even with deer and just all sorts of issues that we do have here. But this is the time to really be putting your planning in. It gets a little tricky sometimes, because then we'll get these hot spells, and then you got to be sure that you're watering what you have in. But as an example, I had one woman who asked me a question. She had all these brown edges on her leaves recently, and she was pretty careful, I think, in the way she installed everything, but she put them in the spring. And if you do that, you have these small root balls, even with, digging extra space around it, and they're going to dry out real quickly. So you've got to put a lot more work in, and Mother Nature will do it for you right now. So this is the time to be putting in your larger plants and shrubs, not fruit trees, because generally you'll get those bare root. Not that you have to, but and that's more like January that you would be planting those. But most everything else, this is a really good time to be doing it. And then you want to look it up or call us and see how drought tolerant some of these things are, because some plants are going to work better than others. And of course, we can't tell you everything. It depend on your soil type and you were talking about partial shade. Those are all kinds of things that you need to take mm-hmm. into consideration, which how close to the ocean you are, potential salt burn, and then winds. The wind can really dry things out too.
Speaking of drought tolerant, I know that plants have to be what they call established before you can lessen the watering. So how long does that take after planting?
It's going to depend on the plant. Some plants need a lot more. Some plants need a lot more water than others. And generally, plants aren't going to be hurt because of extra water. I consider my landscape, I'm pretty careful in the choices I make, because I don't want, again, the maintenance, that's a big part of it. And I water like maybe once every week and a half, hand water my landscape plants, and they seem to do. I think they appreciate the extra water. They would make it, I think, on their own, but they just wouldn't look as healthy and
you're vibrant. Talking about during the summer.
I've always considered it to be established if I'm starting to see new growth on the plant. Is that a good indicator?
Generally, I mean, like I told you as an example about the hop plant that I put in, and just the way all of a sudden these little leaves became big, and then it just popped, it started growing. So yeah, new growth's definitely a good sign that something's happened and it's getting at least somewhat established. Yeah.
Genesee and I planted some rhododendrons in a little garden we built, and they're starting to show new leaves and things like that now. Yeah. And I took that as an indication they're happy.
They generally are.
Have you ever found an app for your phone that is a good plant identifier?
There's numerous apps that will help you get there, but what I find generally is they seem to know the common plants. And when you take a picture of something that's unusual, and you've got to take really good pictures, they're
marginal.
That's the word. They're often marginal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, I generally don't even recommend any for that reason. I just haven't found them that helpful. Yeah. But mm-hmm. not saying, it's fun, and mm-hmm. you can figure out what a lot of plants are that are, especially again, the more common ones, or that have a real distinct leaf pattern or something, so that they're easy to tell what they are. The app can tell easily.
I have a water tower. I get my water from a cistern, and it pumps water into a 5,000 gallon water tank that's about. I don't know.
That's a big water.
It's a good 8 or 10 feet tall, and about 8 feet across on the basin. black and ugly and just right in my backyard. What could I do to cover that? I was told when I moved here that the militia will come take me away if I plant ivy.
Well, you may want to plant something like honeysuckle or clematis. I don't know. There's an evergreen clematis that might work. I like that plant.
So would I have to put some kind of
You're going to need some lattice probably around it, or wire maybe. Might be enough to help you do that.
Okay. What was the name of the evergreen thing again?
Evergreen clematis.
Clematis. Okay.
Yeah, there's clematis that are all sorts of colors, and they have different blooming seasons.
Anything's better than an ugly black, so I don't care what color it is.
Well, and just the thermal kind of storage of in that water tank might benefit it through the winter, especially, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then the black
insulating
would also provide heat, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I have one last question about bulbs. I was always told that you leave the fronds on the daffodil bulbs after they flower, so the strength goes to the bulb.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case for all bulbs?
Yeah, interesting question. I just dug up a whole bunch of naked ladies, and I was talking to my neighbor about this, and the leaves can look really cruddy after, you know, a few months, and I think I'm going to pull them off earlier next year and see what happens. She said she cuts them right away and it has an effect to the flowers. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I think it's going to help the bulbs get bigger and multiply.
For all bulbs?
I would think for most bulbs anyhow, that would be the case. I'm not saying absolutely one thing or another, but I think you're just, you know, those leaves are there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. Makes sense.
So getting back to these pre-emergence for a minute. I have things that have died off now or will die off soon, but the roots are alive, I guess, under the dirt, and then in the spring they're going to... I'm sorry?
Such as?
I don't know what they are. You know me. Genesee comes and she says, "What is this?" And I say, "I don't know. It was $5. That's as much as I know about the names of plants. But anyway, so all these roots are under there, and would the pre-emergent help that from sprouting, or is it already a going concern?
I wouldn't think the pre-emergent would affect the plant in the ground.
Yeah, generally that's...
Even though the plant itself has died off for the winter.
But what would the purpose of the pre-emergent be?
To stop the weed from growing.
The weeds from coming up.
I don't think it would affect the plant.
No.
No, is it going to stop the weed from coming up?
It's meant to.
Okay. And the pre-emergent, the little garden that I was talking about, the Genesee and I did, it was like every time I turned my back, there was more weeds growing up in there, and they were just mocking me. I know they were.
Weeds have a way of doing that.
I'd go around the other side of the house, come back, and there'd be some more.
Yeah.
And I was tempted to put preen on it then, but these plants were not established at all, and I was wondering, do you think that would affect that? No?
Don't think so. I don't know. If they're not established, it might be better to wait, but... You know, one thing that people can do, again, when we talk about mulches, is put down ground cloth, especially ground cloth, not black plastic, but ground cloth where water can get through it. And, you know, rock on top of ground cloth works really well as far as helping keep down weeds. The more rock, the less weeds you'll have coming up. But they do collect soil over time, windblown soil, so it's not going to keep it out forever, but definitely will help.
Yeah, I have a lot of gravel walkways, and things just seem to find a way to grow, even up through the ground cover.
I remember last year in May, the Master Gardeners in Gold Beach had a big plant sale.
Right.
Is that an annual event?
That is an annual event. I'm glad you brought that up. Yep, that's going to be happening again Mother's Day weekend, the Saturday of. And I can't believe how big some of the plants are already that I saw the other day, and they're constantly propagating new ones.
I wish that you did that twice a year.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Like now, Scott, so that we have these plants, this is a good time to plant.
Yeah, that's true.
Why is it that all the stores, I don't know about the the nurseries necessarily, but like Fred Meyer and what's the other one?
Bimart.
They don't have any plants there now. And it's supposed to be a good time to plant.
And that's another conversation I just had with someone today. Until I guess people do more landscaping in the autumn, if there's the demand, then it will happen. If people ask nurseries or wherever they buy their plants to do that, they're going to have more likelihood that they're going to have more available. You can order a lot of plants, like up here at the nursery on Oak Street. You can order them and they'll bring them in for you. Probably Flora Pacifica the same, I imagine. You can get the plants, but you're going to have to seek them out.
Yeah, I went there to Fred Meyer to buy mulch the other day, and they just don't have any. It's gone.
It's seasonal business, but it could be much longer if people took advantage of this planting season.
And this mulch that I buy is a bark mulch, and it's undyed, and after a year, it seems to have composted and turned into soil. Is that in fact good soil?
It's gradually breaking down.
Okay.
Well, Scott, why would you encourage us to become master gardeners?
I would encourage you to become master gardeners for the reason that we have, through extension, this program we offer people throughout the county to support them in their growing pursuits. That's probably the main reason. But I know that most people, you know, they're going to have their selfish reasons, which is perfectly understandable because they want to learn how to grow things in this climate. And you've been here 1 year, and we often get master gardeners who are new to the area because they want to learn those things. Mm-hmm. So it's a great opportunity for that. And probably one of the things people don't think about is you meet some great people.
Oh, I can imagine.
And like-minded folks, gardeners, and I think that a lot of friendships have developed out of that opportunity to learn together.
First week I was here, I went to the local garden club meeting and met so many nice people. They gave me a welcome Brookings plant, and some of my best friends now are those women that I met there.
It's great.
You can go to kciw.org, click on volunteer, and become a KCIW volunteer very easily. And we have mostly nice people, too, except for one. And you'll find out who that is when you volunteer.
And the last plug for the Master Gardener course is go to Curry County Master Gardener online and click on events, and the training is online, or the registration is online right there. And if you have any questions, give me a call at 541-247-6672.
Okay, was that the PSA you wanted to read?
No. Okay. I have that here.
I'd like to thank you very much, Scott, and my co-host, Janice, for showing up today and asking and then answering questions we had. And Scott has given you his phone number. If you need to get more information, you can contact him. Thank you very much for listening to Discussions at Brookings Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Discussion at Brookings Cafe. Become a part of these great discussions. Send an email to contact@kciw.org.
The opinions expressed on this show are those of the participants and not necessarily the opinions of this station.